Good evening. This is Wednesday night. It's Life in the Labyrinth night. And as we've been, for the last several weeks, we're studying the book, Life in the Labyrinth by E.J. Gold. And you can get that at gatewaysbooksandtapes.com. And it's on the site that I maintain, which is wingsofchaos.com. Under Life in the Labyrinth, there's a direct link to where you can purchase that book should you need it. Also coming up here at the Institute over the Easter weekend, which is a couple weeks weekends from now, is the Easter workshop. And that will be held physically here for some who will be present, and then online during the entire weekend is what I understand it to be. And if you want to find out more about that, you can visit idhhb.com.
Right.
Okay? So, Ivan, can you give us a quick synopsis of last week?
No, I can't.
Oh, man.
I was counting on you for that.
I understand.
I just didn't get a chance to listen to the tape either.
Okay.
I would have liked to do.
Where we are is we're working on Chapter 4. The work, Life in the Labyrinth, is a follow-on from The Human Biological Machine as a Transformational Apparatus. And it's part of the whole literature offering from E.J. Gold about transformation, awakening the machine, and creating fundamental change within the spiritual organism that we are. And it begins with the concept of beginning to wake up the machine. And that's part of the work that we do when we're working through the book HBM, or Human Biological Machine. Then we move on to where the essential self starts to take on, let's say, it has a footing of its own. It has a footing of its own, and it in itself starts to be present in the work of the aspirant. So what we're talking about now is that we have, now we're going to study how that works and some of the mechanisms of the Voyager operating in the Bardos. The first three chapters just started to create that distinction. Now in Chapter 4, and that chapter is called
The Keys to Elegant Voyaging.
So in that situation, we're actually starting to delineate some of the elements of voyaging that we will be working with. Necessarily, this is very thick material, so to speak. And the reason it is because we are discussing what it's like to operate and actually be in a new undiscovered country. We're hanging out there, and in the process of hanging out there, certain clues and elements will come forth. And once those clues and elements come forth and we become used to being in that environment, we can begin to discuss the concept of being there elegantly and gracefully.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, Ivan, for the first, and the short chapter, there's so much material in it that we got to... We got about halfway through. I'm going to actually rewind us a little bit to page 27, and we'll skip ahead rapidly to try to get through this in the next hour.
Well,
but
I'll pick up. I'm on a different edition, so I'll try to pick up.
Yeah. Well, I'm on page. Where I want to start is page 27 of the new edition,
right,
which I think is similar, and on the paragraph called "Straight Line Hot Wire Associative Thought."
That's how it starts out.
Yeah. Straight Line Hot Wire Associative Thought.
Okay. I got it.
Okay, good. And is that on the same page?
It's on 25 in the old one.
25, okay. So, straight line associative thought processing can only serve to hinder us as we respond, by well-planned spasmodic reflex to the various traps and traumatic shocks of the labyrinth. I'll just read on for a minute there. But we worry needlessly. It will soon become apparent that there just isn't any way of outguessing the twists and turns that lie ahead of us. The fact is, often we'll be mighty hard-pressed to find any discernible difference between the normal significance of an object in the primate sector and its usefulness and function in the macro dimensions. So what we're talking about is opening our eyes in a different manner. Things that in a certain way seem commonplace and insignificant suddenly become significant, and it's important to grasp that significance, but you can only grasp it if you're in those spaces. If you're not in those spaces, it is insignificant. It makes no sense. Because when we venture into what we are calling the macro dimensions, and you know, every once in a while I'll refer to it as is the life of the essential self. When we're more in that, all facts are different. It is a different set of circumstances. Different sets of values come to bear. So that's what that paragraph is telling us. For instance, let's say that you're a white water rafter, Ivan. You do white water rafting, okay. And you're a guide as a white water rafter. You might go down a particular river 100 times.
Yeah.
Only to find the next time you go down, it's the fundamental characteristics or the accidents and characteristics are different. But if you understand the concept of whitewater rafting and you're in that kind of a mode of attention, you can get through it. So the details may change, but the processes will be the same. Okay?
Are you talking now about skills, like the Voyager skills?
The Voyager skills that we learn. You may traverse, in a sense, the same Voyager pathways, at the same one, so to speak, but it will nevertheless, in its own way, be different. But we learn how to be buoyant and flexible in those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, anyway, I wanted to get us started on that once again to distinguish between this straight line thinking versus the resilience of the thinking that happens when we're more in the Bardo spaces.
Yeah, he's suggesting that it's not what we used to call roof brain thinking. It's not machine thinking. And did you dwell on the? Did you have a discussion at all about this word elegant last week?
No.
Interesting concept.
Yeah, but we are going to get there.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
What we'll head toward the crescendo
okay.
on that point, okay?
Yeah.
That'll be very important as we get toward the end here.
Yeah.
I'm glad
you
brought that up.
I wonder if you hit on something else. I'd be curious to ask people this, because I'm impersonating a professor and an editor tonight. Can't seem to get out of the mode of the last week. If this were in an English composition class, we were analyzing this text around this point, I would ask the students, is there anything that you notice about the style of this chapter, about the style of the text in general, how it's written? I just wonder what impression this makes, let's say, compared to the human biological machine.
Okay, so it would be really useful, very useful, to comment on that.
Mm-hmm.
There's something fundamentally different about the style here. So it's another thing to notice as we go through this text. Another thing to notice. What do you notice now that Ivan has turned our attention to that?
Yeah, it just came to mind because of the sentence you just read. You know, that I believe that paragraph
That whole paragraph.
That paragraph is a sentence,
yeah,
which, in, again, in English composition, I would prohibit my students from writing such a paragraph.
Nevertheless, it's an effective paragraph,
yeah, well,
in this particular context of what it's trying to describe to us.
Yeah.
Okay?
There's something going on with that.
So if you have comments on that, you can either put them on the site at wingsofchaos.com or into the log, and I will post the log later on. Now I turn the page now to page 28, and the paragraph starting, remembering. This is the next critical set of points that's coming up here. Remembering what we did 3 or 4 games ago, perhaps even in a different game, or 3 or 4 lifetimes ago, is another important aspect of successful voyaging. No amount of luck will be very useful if we do not remember what we did. Without remembering, we are condemned to repeat our mistakes forever. But this is not the sort of remembering which we can depend upon the mind or any other function which rightfully belongs with and performs its own one-way swan song in syncopated duet with the human biological mission. So talk about repeating there. Remembering. I'm going to stay on that paragraph for a minute because I want to ask the question, what does it mean here to remember? How do you remember? What techniques do you bring to the game? When you get into that space, can you remember? Now, Silverdale has often told us that there is a recognition when he's in this space called the essential self of a vibratory sensation. Is this about right, Silverdale?
Yep.
Okay. So if the tonal mark is some form of a vibratory sensation, then subtle differences in that vibratory sensation might be able to tell you that you're in a different space. Okay? That you're in the grand space, but maybe differences will tell you you're in a different position therein. That will come up in a few minutes, but it's turning our attention to it. What is a way to remember? What are just some, just in a simple way, no magical or mysterious or, you know, super esoteric, alchemical, blah, blah, blah. What are just some simple ways to remember? How do you remember stuff? Like, Ivan, how did you remember to get from the house to here?
Well, a lot of it has to do with habits, doesn't it? I mean, you remember, you react or you behave appropriately in the situation because it's your habit to react or behave that way.
And you've probably walked from there to here 1,000 times.
Repetition. There's repetition
so
involved.
So one way of remembering is repetition.
Mm-hmm.
Another way of remembering is to write it down. You could write down the directions.
Document.
You can document the directions. Here's another way of remembering. You tell another person. Now, in this realm, when you remember in that manner, what we are talking about then is a form of confession. It's higher confession. You're declaring it into the space. And when you do that, it's marked. And when you get back to that space, that mark point will be there for you. How do you remember? If you have suggestions like that, you can either put them in the log or on the site, because people will want, they're looking for clues and what I call ways and means. We're always looking for ways and means to traverse these this is our homeland that we're talking about, our true homeland. And it's taken us a while to get here, so let's begin to claim it. Okay?
I think there's also a very strong point in this paragraph you just read, the correspondence between repeating a game over and over again and having repeated lifetimes. It's sort of subtle the way he slips that into that paragraph, but it's, if you know, on the principle as below, so above, the principle of correspondences,
yeah,
he's actually implicitly, like not sort of directly saying, but he's implicitly saying there that the practice of Diablo, for example, or the practice of some game over and over again is a stand-in, a correspondence to having lifetimes over and over again, or the same lifetime, let's say, over and over again, and practicing this recall.
I like that.
Skill of remembering.
Yeah, I like that concept of correspondence.
Well, I wonder if there's a giveaway in here.
In the next paragraph.
Here's what he says, remembering what we did three or four games ago, perhaps even in a different game, or three or four lifetimes ago. So it's like, you know, you're playing a game, can you remember? Oh, how about a lifetime, can you remember?
And you might be able to.
Yeah.
And you might be able to. So in the next paragraph it says, for this kind of remembering, we must develop something which survives the death of the machine, mm-hmm. something which is called, in our technical language, understanding, a semi-intuitional recall, a sixth sense, which comes from the unprocessed knowledge, which tells us that something is wrong or right, even if we don't know exactly what it is.
When I read that, I wondered, why did he pick that, knowing
Correct.
That something is wrong?
Well, because there is a tone of here of, you know, that he has throughout of putting the Voyager on notice, you know, making us a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, he talks about the dangers in this chapter.
And that's in there, too. So this idea of the sixth sense, and when I review myself a little bit, I realize that I rely on that sixth sense more than I rely on my other five senses. It's more of a guide for me.
I don't think that I do ordinarily, but I think this goes along with what you were, when you were talking about Silverdale's characterization of the difference in the space. You know,
yeah.
It's like if you can detect it when you've made these, when the changes happen in the space, one of the things that the habit that should kick in is that you don't calculate at that point. You don't necessarily do the Sherlock Holmes thing. You know,
the deduction.
Yeah, the quick, the strict linear calculation.
You might lead to.
Yeah, or that it seems to me there's an openness. You know, when you want an openness or a surrender to something there.
Nice.
And you know, it's from the point of view of the machine, it's a bit scary. But it's a surrender to the essential self mode, right? You know, that's what he's talking about here.
So jumping ahead about three paragraphs, but with knowledge transubstantiated into understanding.
Understanding, yeah.
Transubstantiated understanding. When we do happen to smell something burning, well, at least we'll at least be able to discern that this time probably isn't the toast.
Interesting joke.
Yeah, but it's that we might have different eyes. Now, certain chambers may appear populated with creatures strange, sinister, and fearsome, encouraging us to squeak by, missing the chance to fully savor the whole, digging deeper until we understand what we've got hold of. If we escape a trap too quickly, we won't have time to examine the irreparable damage. What does that mean, Ivan? Why is he saying that?
I don't know. I'd be interested in knowing what people got out of that paragraph.
Okay, this is an interesting paragraph.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, I don't know who's on right now, but I wonder if that strikes a bell in anybody.
Yeah, Jana, we got any comments? How about who's on the phone?
Silverdale, I think.
Irreparable damage.
Irreparable damage. And the whole idea is that the one suggestion here that I find fascinating is if we escape a trap too quickly, we won't have time to examine the irreparable damage. We won't.
Yeah.
So you have to know when to escape just at the right time, because if you react out of it, you don't get anything. You don't remember it at all. It's in a certain way you have to feel the burning sensation of the fire burning so that when you come back to it, that's marked for you. That's a point in the path that is marked.
So that it could, this could also be referring to those chambers of the not-so-friendly guides in the macro dimensions. You know, in the Book of the Dead, the friendly guides, the Voyager is the orientation would be to merge with the brightest lights and to merge and join with these friendly guides. Well, I believe with the, he actually changed in the editions of the Book of the Dead from the unfriendly guides or the hostile guides, he changed it to the unresponsive, thank you, Jana, the unresponsive guides. Right, because it's like, it's not that they're malevolent. You know, they don't have it in for you. You know, that's, there's a paranoia that comes from the mind. But, yeah, the unresponsive guides are, you know, there's some other attitude that you take towards them, I believe, in chambers. But like David is saying, you don't rush out.
You don't
abruptly
don't
escape.
Panic. Don't panic. Sometimes you have to hold in there in order to mine the data that's there for you particularly.
Yeah, this sounds like one that's going to take practice.
Sometimes it can be valuable to relax the machine. But given the fact that certain macro-dimensional creatures are very unforgiving, although in a totally impersonal way, and very deadly, we shouldn't depend on it. And we do make mistakes. Then in the next paragraph after that, it's in the labyrinth, fear will instantly catapult us into the lowest of primate levels, while panic makes us react reflexively. So we are going to have fear, and for me, part of the concept is not to panic about it. The fear can actually be used. It's that you can use that as a source of fuel.
It seems to me this is also getting into the elegant part, right? I mean, this is the
exactly right.
That's right. You know, you don't go caroming around like a pinball, you know, in a pinball machine.
Yeah.
Because it's not elegant to react. To panic, to react to make sudden moves. You know,
and even if
not
something,
making any sudden moves.
Let's say something is occurring that is definitely not right.
Yeah.
You can panic and run, or you can stop and say, no, thank you. I don't want to go that way. And I have to keep, I refer back to this scene in The Golden Child, which I've used many, many times.
Yeah, which one?
Where Eddie Murphy, toward the end of the movie, and the evil creatures got so frustrated that rather than showing up in the human form, he takes the full
the monster
creature form, and he's in this room, and he's in this creature form. He's like 7-8 feet tall. There's flames. Eddie Murphy walks into the room. He sees this and he goes, oh, I see you're busy. And he walks out.
Yeah, right.
So he didn't fight that power in the manner that power had at that moment, but he didn't also discount it.
Right.
He recognized it and he fought it with a different form of different tool, in this case called humor.
Humor, yeah, right.
And it was successful. So you don't know what tool you're going to bring forth, but whatever it is, you'll bring forth some tool. Sometimes you have to hang in there. And now I'm going to jump ahead again about three or four paragraphs. I'm now on page 30. It may not be immediately evident, but at some point we'll become aware of a central switching exchange, a Tipperath, from which all other domains are only a phone call away. This central exchange can be in itself either passive or active in relation to the shamanic voyager. Do we know what Tipperath means, Ivan?
I know the context. I meant to look up the tree of life. It's the middle. I'm sure it's the heart.
It's sometimes called the heart of the labyrinth. It's also where the Christ consciousness is said to reside.
Well, but for those who are familiar with it, this is the Kabbalah, the diagram of the Sephiroth in the nine centers, and it's, you know, it can be set up as a correspondence with the body, like chakras in the body, or with realities in a sense, with an entire universe. And there's that Tipharet in the middle has what DJ is referring to here, is that there are pathways from Tipharet, there are pathways to 2, 3, 4, either at least 4 or 5 of the other locations, the other archetypes, let's say, in the pattern, or maybe to all of them. Anyway, it's more or less, I think he's saying that it's more or less connected to all of them.
Know at this point that it is there, that that's just something about the nature of voyaging in the labyrinth.
Mm.
Jumping ahead a little bit, by waiting, and waiting well, neither impatiently or nonchalantly, for the right combination to occur, we can take advantage of open trunk lines and climb onto the bus in which we can exit from our present location of the labyrinth, passing inevitably through the central switching station, the heart of the labyrinth. That's a method to get somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then jumping ahead a little bit, some methods of movement can be discovered by trial and error, the expensive way, others by research, the time-consuming and often misleading way, some by inquiry about the best way of obtaining unusual answers.
Hmm.
What is that?
Yeah, that paragraph struck me in the recent reading.
So I wrote next to it, nota bene.
What does that mean?
Note well.
Nota bene, yeah, okay.
Note well. So this is a critical paragraph in this book and in this particular chapter, and it leads us right to the start of the concept of elegant voyaging. So what are some of the methods? What do you mean by trial and error? And how do you capture those moments? It's directly linked into the concept of remembering.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How do we capture the moments of trial and error? How do you even know if it's an error or not? The first part of the answer is, I don't know. Gosh, I don't know. There is no linear answer to this stuff. But if, as Ivan said earlier, you're willing to enter into a space of a form of surrender, you can sit there and you can share with somebody, I don't know what it means, but this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can glean from that the fruit.
Would you call that inquiry? See, that's beginning to sound like inquiry.
And now we're in the mode of inquiry.
Because to me, the trial and error is, yeah, you know, when you die or you go back to the beginning of that passage in the game, you know, you keep turning up, you know, back in the respawning room or something, that's trial and error, and you just
you
keep battering your head against it, and you figure out, oh, it has to, I have to move this way, or these are the moves that keep me from going back to the spawning room at this particular spot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's so trial and error. I mean, you know, that's generally the way I approach games, is you know, I do it by trial and error. But maybe, you know, after you've done enough games or enough of the same game, enough repetitions, let's say, you know, then you become more elegant. You know, you have integrated or grokked, you know, the
do you remember
the pattern, the behaviors, you know.
Do you remember the story I talked about with those elite bodyguard guys?
Yeah.
And where they train with paintball guns.
Right. Okay.
And part of their training is they're walking in an urban environment or running in an urban environment. They come around a corner and they get shot with a paintball, which is very painful. And at first, of course, they react, stop, and they're done with.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, even knowing they are going to be hit by that,
mm-hmm.
they know to be able to still respond and get a shot or two off, nevertheless.
Oh, that's the training.
That's the training. Are you going to get hit? Yes. Something we haven't talked about, and we will talk about in other chapters, is what's called the cleansing radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And in some of the chapters in the American Book of the Dead and some of those chambers, they talk about this, the red hot
mm-hmm.
light or purple, and leaving yourself in that chamber because there's a cleansing element that occurs.
It's the intense, what do they call it? The intense radiation.
If we in fact are, and we have concluded that we are,
mm-hmm.
electrical beings, then the electrical being called the essential self is being cleansed. It's not being cleansed. It's the machine that is being cleansed. The habits within the machine that continue on. And they're cleansed so that the pure essential self can emanate as it so well should.
Hmm.
So trial and error. And this is why we have to explore the idea of working together. And in working together, we actually discover these specific things about ourselves. Okay?
What do you think these unusual answers are?
Okay, this is good. I'm glad you brought that up. The unusual answers are the answers that are not linear. They are not, you won't even think of it in a linear manner, and suddenly you say, this is going to sound really strange, and you bring it up, and it's the right answer for
mm-hmm.
the space.
Yeah.
Because it's not coming from the same source of answers coming from a different place altogether. It's coming from the infinitude of creativity that rests in the world where the essential self operates from. And in that infinitude, the answers are always fresh. And they're always different.
There's some place, I don't know, is it still to come or did we pass by that? There's a statement about probability that
we passed it. Yeah.
In spite of the probabilities, there is actually no guarantee that anything's going to go according to the odds, according to the majority view, let's say, or the usual, the ordinary outcome. It's not necessarily predictable.
Hey, Ivan, I can't help but think when I read this paragraph, I can't help but think of Carlos Castaneda talking to Don Juan and Don Juan talking to him about inorganic beings and the possibility of allying with them. Well, that would be a very unusual answer.
Right.
He wasn't a Navajo, he was a Yaqui, but...
Yeah, well, actually, you know, it's funny you should say that, George. I was just down in Tucson. One of the things that I, just by association, being in the desert there in Tucson, I thought of this passage in Castaneda where basically Don Juan has him voyaging with Mescalito or something. He's on peyote buttons or something like that, and he's and he goes into, he has basically a major romance with a dog. You know, he gets intensely involved with a dog, you know, in
yeah.
a sort of
that was the initial
otherworldly way, yeah.
His initial initiation
yeah.
into the Mescalito world.
Yeah.
And what does Carlos do, which surprised everybody? He played with it.
Yeah, right.
He didn't get afraid. He played with it.
I think actually they all laughed because the dog pissed on him and then he pissed on the dog or something like that.
And that was another element of it.
Yeah.
But it was
play
it's
for
that
a dog.
he had
yeah.
fun with it.
Yeah.
So it's like he got thrown into the fearful world and suddenly he was playful.
Yeah.
He was able to be frolicking and playful.
And this is like the golden child. It's the same,
precisely.
What would you call it, remedy. It's the same, or
it is a remedy.
Habit, not a remedy. It's a right action. You know, it's a form of right action, but you take it in the moment. You don't say, okay, where's my a book of 1,001 jokes or something, you know, but it's something that happens in the moment.
It just happens.
Actually, I love that. I love that moment in the golden child when he figures, like, when he realizes he's been carrying this glass of water and he can't spill a drop and so on, and then he figures out, oh, okay, and he drinks it. He drinks the glass of water, you know, which is certainly unexpected for the viewer.
Yeah, and when he's going down that impossible path,
yeah.
and the guy says, always stay on the path.
Yeah, right.
And then he has to go off the path, and the guy says, oh, you also have to know when you have to leave the path.
Yeah, <right. laughs>
and that's a good explanation of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, right.
Because it is not linear. So what do we do with our big brains that we have? Because we're so smart, we actually believe we can figure it out. And I look at some of these forums, like these fourth wave forums and stuff, and you got these big brainiacs there
yeah,
figuring it out.
Yeah, right. David, I don't know if I should say this now, but they should try. They should have been there in Frankfurt, Germany, when Master Lee Lazowick takes all his vegetarian disciples out, and he says, "Oh, this is my favorite Turkish souvlaki place," and then he has them all eat this floppy, greasy, you know, lamb souvlaki.
Yeah, I don't know if I would do that, but just from a, you know, that's a different sort of thing. But
yeah,
it's putting yourself into an unusual situation and seeing what you do with it. So, and it's seeing what you do with it is what we keep coming back to. So I'm going to jump ahead again. Mood, you there?
Yep.
Mood, in the negative emotional sense, maintains the occlusion matrix of the human domain. But in the macro dimensions, we use higher moods represented as various forms of love, not in the primate sense, not the single emotional ordinarily associated with biological, but an entire spectrum of new emotion in thousands of forms, degrees, and boundless definitions. What is that, Ivan? What does he mean by love there?
I don't know. It's great. It sounds like the...
Yes, you
know,
do.
I know what he means by love.
Yes,
sounds,
you do.
I know that he's talking about something that begins to sound like the table of elements, you know. It's like the physics of love. They say, they're all these... There's like with one less proton or electron or something, it joins up like this with another element and so on. Like,
that,
you know, all kinds of shades and nuances. About.
One of the forms of love is that we're attracted to something.
Mm-hmm.
And if the attraction is human and it happens to be with somebody of the opposite sex, it does go primate.
Mm-hmm.
And if it stays there, then game over.
Right.
But it's a marker to be able to be, you're compelled to want to interact in the, what I call the playground of the essential self. You want to be with somebody who is in that space. That's, and you're attracted to it. There's a magnetism to want to be in that. And if you are surrendered to your own inner love at that point, then you're there without hunger, nothing you don't want or need anything, but you can be there and interact, and there's a freshness to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll have different subtleties at different points. Okay? So, we've talked about navigating by mood, and now it comes right before us. And now we begin to see what could be meant by elegant voyaging.
Mm-hmm.
Macrodimensional mood building occurs quite apart from any nervous system alteration or bioelectrical enhancement as found in meditations. Macro mood is not the result of biophysical effects. So he says it in a negative way here.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And it is far superior and senior, but it may eventually show some effects on the biological machine, and in fact it does, of a well-seasoned voyager who really cooks in the higher dimensions. So why is it different? And how can you develop it once again? How is it different?
The macro mood?
Yeah. So it's an energy. It's an energy that begins, it is possible for us to access, but not, it can get shanghaied by the machine. We have to remember the machine is always there. The hunger of the machine, the ego is almost always present. It's always hungering to be reintroduced to the situation, the great savior.
Mm-hmm.
I'll save you from the fear. All you need to do is just become primate again. Run away from that, and you can go right back to the machine. And in HBM, don't forget he talks about that the part of the fear of waking up is the inability for us to recall how to reassert our sleep.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When we all leave this class in about 20 minutes, we will be more in the macro-dimensional space than we were. To the extent that we are, we will have to reincorporate or recorporealize, if that's even a word,
mm-hmm. Maybe.
And in order to go about our life again. And that transit is just as important and as elegant, and how we do it is just as important. Okay?
Reentry.
Talking about reentry here. The selection of coworkers, a crew, is based partly on what sector of the labyrinth we may need to access, partly on aptitude, which would include tolerance of higher levels and the events we would be likely to encounter and hopefully pass through. And we've talked about being in these spaces where there's 15, 20, 5, 6, 7, 8 people, and as it gets more intense, certain people just fall asleep. They're not there anymore. They're not in that space. They opt out. And then we have the special assembly of varying typicalities can produce different and very visible voyaging results. And then jumping ahead. New reflex reactions to entirely unfamiliar reality structures and new dimensional morphologies must be thoroughly tested in a safe environment, a sector not too far removed from the primate level, where no matter what happens, we know not too much damage is likely to result. In this light, we can see a definite need for serious training toward better reactions and institutional solutions to puzzles.
Intuitional.
So those two paragraphs together are very important. And in a certain way, we can't be tested beyond our ability, unless you stop paying attention, If you pay attention, you always have a chance of recovering. was it, who fought the angel again, Molly?
Jacob.
Jacob fought the angel.
Jacob
fought the angel. The angel came and wrestled with Jacob, but did not defeat him, but introduced him to a very, very difficult space. And we won't go into that in detail. And then, and now you are different at the end of it, the Lord says to him, this angel says to him, because he doesn't reveal who he is. The angel says to Jacob, he even says, what is your name? And he knew it was Jacob. But he says, what's your name? Who are you? And Jacob basically says, well, you know who I am. And then the angel says to him, now your name is Israel.
Changed his name.
Now, and because he is now different. And we're not talking about being different, that your behavior is now different, that you've rearranged the furniture, as Gurdjieff says, but you've actually made an electrical, fundamental electrical change in the being. Sometimes changing your behavior might help allow you to begin accessing those spaces. Because if your behavior, your external behavior, is too crusty or difficult, you can't even approach it. And you get kicked out of those chambers too rapidly. So you might need to change it. It's an interactive process. As you get further along, you might need to change it so you can get further along. But your intuition will tell you it's not an either or. None of this stuff is, Ivan.
In this type of voyage. Yeah.
So jumping ahead a couple of paragraphs, rats who achieve maze brightness rapidly are also capable of untraining and unlearning. An important part of learning, particularly in rapidly shifting reality structures, while rats which do not achieve maze brightness show no evidence of the ability to unlearn previously acquired skills. So we're introduced now not only to the idea of how you behave, but also unlearning, as was just introduced to us. Unlearning our habits so we can go a little further. Unlearning is a very important and powerful prerequisite to relearning. To relearn means to empty an established neural pathway. It's not bad or wrong. It's not saying that. It's just to empty it. Because you realize that if you hold on to it, it doesn't allow you to go forward. As Basho would say, you can't pour more tea in the cup unless it's until it's empty. Without aptitude and attitude, nothing further is possible. From that point on, if one has aptitude and doesn't tend to react violently to the unexpected, one can learn to take risks. And the biggest risk of all is to wait and see, to do nothing. If one can be trusted implicitly without the slightest shred of doubt, not to betray themselves, then one may be accepted as a co-voyager in more dangerous, radical, and unexpected conditions. And he concludes the paragraph, having been through the labyrinth thousands of times myself, I've certainly come to know what to expect. But you can prepare others, cannot prepare others, by explanation alone. No amount of preparation really does much more than exploit good characteristics already present in the voyager. Either one reacts well in the macro dimensions or one doesn't. And so we've talked about that extensively, that you're here in part because you react well, because you have that aptitude. And now the challenge in this chapter is to mine that aptitude. Don't deny it. don't concentrate constantly on what you can't do. That's one technique. That is one technique of work. But at some point, embrace what you can do, because when you embrace that part of it, when you embrace what you can do, you begin to shoulder the responsibility for it. And what is that responsibility? And when your head rises above the water, that you feel like you're drowning in for one moment, and you come to a moment of clarity, and you write that moment of clarity down for your fellow voyager, and you leave that there on the path for them to find,
mm-hmm.
guess what? They know the way up that particular rock face that nobody could solve before. You solved it, and you just have to tell them, turn left here, go up, sideways, and then up. Then you'll find your way through. But what a valuable tool that is. And this is part of the form of remembering, but it's remembering together. And if we can remember together, we're all enhanced by it. Each of us is. So if you remember something and you share it with another, really, in a certain way, I've got that. And if I can share that back, you've got that. And if you've got it, others have it. And that's how it goes. We then lift each other up in that manner. There's no question that that occurs. We're
yeah.
doing it right now, aren't
working,
we?
Yeah, working in the cell. It's like we have a cell of people that are working
How
together.
Many people are there, Jen? 17 people are all enhanced by each other.
He uses the term a crew in here. The selection of co-voyagers, a crew. You know, so this is a team. This is a matter of the mountain climbers that are roped together. You know, it's a team. It's a project that requires teamwork.
And look at the team that has gathered. There's a team here and another team there. That's the team that has gathered. It is a team that is gathered by however. But the fact of the matter is it is gathered, and here it is. And so that's the team that we take advantage of.
You know, something, David, I don't want to pass by, though, especially if by the end is sort of like the path, the directionality of this chapter, what he arrives at here at the end. It suggests to me, it's like here you have EJ, you know, you have the shaman, you know, the elegant
speaking,
voyager
yeah.
par excellence is saying, having been through the labyrinth thousands of times myself, I've certainly come to know what to expect. So this is the pro, you know, this is the expert. He's saying you can't prepare. He, the shaman, can't prepare others by explanation alone. No amount of preparation really does much more than exploit good characteristics already present in a voyager or, let's say, in the team. Either one reacts well to the macro mentions or one doesn't. But what this suggests to me is he's touched on in various ways all through this chapter the element of risk that's involved, and it comes up over and over again in this book, that to make this progress in the essence life, in other words, to move on into the essential self life and to move the essential self on into new areas, let's say,
yes.
untried areas.
Uncharted, yeah.
Labyrinth, you know, this thing where the occurrences go against probabilities, where the expected doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
You know, where the object that in the ordinary chamber is a salt shaker, you know, or a chair or whatever, is now has a completely new significance.
That's
in the
right.
space. So what just strikes me, and maybe it's because I'm a past professional paranoid, but that there's risk involved. In other words, to bring your team along, to be able to give that. What were you saying? The understanding, to have an element of understanding and then be able to pass it on to others or pass it around in a team that's working together. There's somebody is having to take the risk of the unknown to begin with.
That's right.
You know, and it's like he's saying, it's like he's pointing to it to me very clearly. He's saying, I've been through the labyrinth thousands of times myself. It's sort of like by repetition, 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 repetition. If you can remember it, you know, the understanding has come, and then you're a really professional, you're an accomplished voyager. But for all of us, there's somewhere between novice and, you know, and semi-amateur, semi-professional, whatever training grounds. And, you know, so it strikes me that there's, in going out into unknown areas, or let's say unfamiliar areas of the labyrinth, there are all these risks.
There are risks, but I'll flip that.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll flip you.
Yeah.
And the other half of it, he says, all you're doing is exploiting aptitudes that are already there in the Voyager. So here's a challenge to each one of you that is here at this moment in this space. What is that aptitude that is about to be and has been being exploited in a positive manner here? What is that aptitude that you bring to this space? Because you bring that aptitude, and for me, some of them are very clear and distinct. It's clear and distinct what they are. What aptitude then can you say, ah, yes, I bring that aptitude? Not from an ego point of view, but just as a simple inventory of recognition. If we're here, all of us, and all of us are here, there's a reason why we were here together to read that part of that paragraph in this particular book. And that, Molly, are there any? Okay. That brings us to another close to the class. And just as important as it is to open it properly, it's important to close in a simple manner as well. Not too abruptly, not to leave the space, but to leave it in a simple and elegant manner. Knowing and recognizing that we've been together for this last hour. So thank you for coming, and we'll change directions a bit next week when we hit Chapter 5. And Ivan, what's the name of that chapter?
Neural Network Projection.
So it's got a slightly different flavor as you read through that chapter.
Neural Network.
Take a chance, read through the chapter, and as we close this class, I'd like to ask Ivan to read the closing quatrain, or whatever
the
it is.
Coda.
The end of Chapter 4 as we conclude Chapter 4. So thank you, Adam.
The more deeper we go, the harder it be to decode so many a message.
There you go. That seems to say it all.
Sure it does.
Thanks for coming. We'll see you next week.
Good night.
Thanks, David and Ivan.
Thank you, Silverdale.